Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Book now available. In this exciting, one-of-a-kind book, Phil Naylor revisits the very best interviews from 3 years of education podcasting.
Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about educational books, why we love them, and how we use them in our classrooms. With guest authors, publishers, podcasters, and of course, teachers.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Naylor's Natter. This one is coming out hopefully around about October, half term, and it'll give you a perfect opportunity to delve into this book. And also, it will be a perfect link to the book's title, because half term gives us all a little bit of time to think. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Rachel Johnson, and she's going to be talking about her new John Catt book, which is called Time to Think, The Things That Stop Us and How to Deal with Them. Rachel, welcome to Naylor's Natter.
Thank you so much for having me. Absolute pleasure.
Absolutely. Right. So let's get into the question that we ask all our guests to start off with. For listeners that aren't aware of you, and I'm sure that plenty are through your other role, as well as being the leading author of this book. Tell us a little bit about you, your career in education to this point.
Okay. So I started teaching a little while ago now. Always wanted to be a teacher since I was very, very little. So never thought about doing anything else. I was an English teacher, then head of department in two schools, an assistant head in charge of raising standards across English and maths. And then I decided to leave and have some children. So had three. And then in that time when I was busy having these children, ended up working for Pixel, doing some consultancy work to start off with and being an associate. And then eventually ended up on staff. And I'm now leading the company. So quite a journey.
Quite a journey indeed. So just tell us a little bit about this book and the thought process, because as I mention every week, Rachel, I'm a, what's the opposite of best-selling author? I'm a non-selling author, but I have been an author. So tell us a little bit about the process of this. What kind of drove you to write this book, how long it's taken, and what kind of influences you've had in kind of putting this book together?
So I think, I wanted to write it for a while, not because I wanted to write a book necessarily, but because I couldn't find a book that answered the questions that I had. And I found that actually for a very long time when I first started in teaching, I was trying to find something like the book I've written to help me, but I couldn't find anything around difficult conversations, around healthy boundaries. And when I started teaching, that wasn't the kind of conversation that was happening. You know, you didn't have a boundary. That was the conversation. You worked later and later, and it was kind of wearing exhaustion like a trophy. And I didn't like it then. I certainly don't like it now. And I think the issue around all of this is somebody's got to be brave enough to change the narrative and to say, actually, being a people pleaser isn't helpful to people. Nobody's pleased. Nobody's pleased if you're a people pleaser. You're not pleased. They're not pleased. It's a fake idea, really. And so I thought, you know what? I want to tackle this. And so I've been practicing with this content for a few years now in our School of Pixel Leadership and have worked with about 800 leaders, all of whom say they struggle with what I've written about in this book, which is ultimately why I've written it.
Great stuff. Now, a disclaimer and an honest admission for the listener, for the regular listener. Now, normally, you know, I do try to pride myself on reading all the books before I do the interviews. But unfortunately, this time, it's ironic, isn't it, in a way, Rachel, that I've not had time to think about the book.
But I only sent it 2 days ago, to be fair, so you didn't have a lot of time to think anyway.
That's true. But having had a quick scan through and having had a look at the headlines and the chapter titles, I'm incredibly excited to get into this, because this has been something that we've been discussing on recent episodes. Now, obviously, I don't want you to offer any judgment on previous guests, but certainly chapter one, which is how to know what you stand for and what you stand against, was certainly a recurring theme in my conversation with Barry Smith last week around what kind of things that head teachers might stand for, what they might stand against, and how they can convey that and what influence that has on the school population as a whole. So I guess the first question is your chapter title. How do you know what you stand for? How do you know what you stand against? And what kind of impact can that have on your professional dealings?
And it's a massive question, isn't it? And I think it's the question to ask. In terms of what I stand for, I stand for integrity, humility, kindness, and a pursuit towards excellence. That's what I've always stood for. That's what my organisation now stands for. And I think that is so important, because everything about your behaviour comes from what you stand for and what you believe actually as a human being. And so I think you can stand for certain positions in education, you can have opinions, you can be polarised one way or the other, but ultimately how you come across in your everyday life depends on what you personally stand for and what you believe about human beings. And so I think it's really important for leaders to ask themselves, what are the values that you stand for? And what are the values that you'll stand against? And certainly when I was a very young teacher, I always wanted to be head of department. And so I watched all the people around me and I created a little book, which sounds ridiculous, but it was really helpful for me. And the first part of the book was titled Things I Will Do When I'm Head of Department. And at the end of the book, it said Things I Will Not Do When I'm Head of Department. And I watched people's behaviour and I added things to the book as I saw behaviour unfold, because people know if you've not worked for somebody who you respect or whose values clash with yours, it doesn't matter how great the curriculum is, you don't want to be there. And I think that's the issue. It's about how we behave as human beings and how we come across and whether we value people or not and how we show that. So I think when I'm talking about what you stand for, it's entirely around how we behave as people.
Great stuff. And I'm just looking at this culture design canvas, Rachel.
That Now,
I absolutely love this. Talk us through that a little bit, because it's a beautiful graphic for a start. And I know how hard that is to get into books. So that's really good. And I can imagine that lots of people who are, you know, potentially projecting themselves forward into whatever it is, particular roles, this is a really good place to start. Because as listeners will know, I've been wrestling with a lot of, you know, what I think I stand for. And I've got to be honest with listeners, I'm failing a lot recently in terms of some of those things that, you know, potentially I would stand for in terms of, you know, like you said, leader by example, trying to have, and people will be laughing at the podcast, people like, you know, this idea of positivity, because I'm probably the grumpiest persons, people that anybody knows. So tell us how important it is, like I said before, to try and make sure that you know what you stand for, but also how to kind of keep that up. And you've talked also about how identifying some of the features that you don't necessarily appreciate in other people can then influence how you are as a leader to make people more comfortable.
So I think the culture canvas that you mentioned, I got that originally when I saw it for Netflix, and that's what they did. And they tried to work out as a group of people what they stood for, what they believed, and then how that exhibited in the company. And I think that's a really good place to start, because any person can say what they stand for. It's really easy, just words that you string together in a nice motto or a tagline. But the more important thing, I think, is to say, so what? So if I say to you that I stand for humility, so what? What does that look like when someone questions my authority? What does that look like when I'm under pressure? What does that look like when I'm tired or when I make a wrong decision or when I feel out of my depth? What does humility look like in all of those circumstances? And I think that's what we don't ask ourselves. We say the word, but unless we kind of say, well, so what? How is humility going to show itself through my behavior in all these different circumstances? Then we haven't really grappled with it at all. And what the culture canvas does is allow you to look at different elements of running a company, things like, you know, how we're going to handle feedback, or how we know what we stand for, or what behaviours do we punish, what behaviours do we reward, and then really think through, you know, what do we do in this company or our school? How do we give feedback? And I think in things like senior leadership meetings, if the conversation is never brought up, like how do we challenge each other in this meeting? If that's never been a discussion you've had as an SLT, I think there's a problem, because people don't want to challenge unless there's permission to do so. But for permission to be granted, there has to be openness and willingness to hear what a person wants to say, even if it's not what you want to hear. And that's where humility comes in, having the humility to say, I think I've got this right, but I am humble enough to accept I might have got it wrong.
Brilliant. Thank you, Rachel. Right, let's get into chapter two, which is another fascinating discussion.
It's a biggie one, this one.
Yeah, so they've got quite a few bits on this. So let's just start with a definition of, I mean, I think people understand the concept of people pleasing, but particularly in education, what do you mean by people pleasing?
Well, I think the problem in education is that I think most teachers are people pleasers, certainly a lot that I've met, because we think that people pleasing is serving others. And most teachers want to serve others. We do things above and beyond the call of duty. We literally feed young people. We buy pens, we buy rubbers, we buy them pencil cases. We spend our own money. We do after school clubs with no payment. We take them on residentials at great inconvenience to our own families. We serve other people's children over and above our own children. So that is a life of service, really, in this profession. And I think where people pleasing and service get mixed up is we start doing things to collect gold badges because we think that's where our worth comes from. And that's the problem. So people pleasing is defined as trying to control someone else's emotions to make you feel better about yourself. And actually, when defined like that, it's very manipulative. And in 2020, when I came across a number of books around this topic and I heard that definition, I thought, you know what? I don't want to be manipulative. That's not what I stand for at all. And so if people pleasing is controlling other people's emotions so I feel better about myself, that's got to stop. And so I describe myself as a recovering people pleaser. I've had to learn a different way of being, and it's uncomfortable to say no to people, really uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to say, I could come to that party, but I don't want to because it's not massively socially acceptable. But I think in teaching, we have to get to a point where we say, I don't want to do that. Because if we don't say that, we end up being really resentful when we feel we're being made to. And I think that is a real problem in education. Lots of people who care deeply, who want to serve wholeheartedly, in the end getting resentful because they're not thanked, they don't see the rewards, and ultimately they don't think it's worth it. And so people pleasing, I think, is at the heart of human beings, the struggle that we have. But I think in teaching it is particularly a thing. And because we're always rewarded for it, aren't we? If you stay up late and you give up everything and sacrifice everything and you're the last one at the car park, that's like somehow weirdly rewarded. Who is that pleasing exactly? I genuinely don't know anymore.
No, and I just skipping forward a little bit on the same theme, Rachel, which is that you've pulled some research from another book, which is, I think it's from, is it called Please Yourself?
That's brilliant. Yeah, Please Yourself by Emma Reid Terrell. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm just looking through and I'm thinking, I'm just trying to classify which type of people pleaser I am. And of course, as I've previously alluded to, the world's grumpiest man currently. So I'm perhaps the resistor people pleaser, aren't I? Of all this all guns blazing of, you know, I'm not really care, I don't really mind, but secretly and really, I want to be. Well, not popular. I might want to be invited to a party occasionally to be able to say no to it. That might be good as well. But just talk to us about those different types of people pleaser and, you know, perhaps which one you might classify yourself as.
Oh, it's a really interesting question, isn't it? So she defines four different types of people pleaser. And I think a lot of them are quite similar to each other. So it's worth reading her book and hearing the full explanation of them all. But essentially, they all have something in common. So the first one is the classic people pleaser. That's got a perfectionist tendency. Everyone's going the extra mile to be the most thoughtful, most helpful. Nothing is ever too much trouble. You thrive on appreciation. And I think there is part of me that was that. I didn't have perfectionist tendencies, but I wanted to definitely be the most thoughtful. And so, you know, you think of thoughtful gift, I'm going to up that by about five times, you know, because I'm going to really go out of my way to think. It's sometimes great inconvenience, I have to say to myself, and very little appreciation. The shadow people pleaser is someone who's grown up in the shadow of somebody else who has always got the attention. And I think, you know, and these people make brilliant wing men or women. And I think I think I put myself in that role for a lot of my career, thinking I'll just follow the charismatic people and like do a really good job for them and help their spotlight be bigger and try and serve them. And I'll be the person who makes it all happen behind the scenes. I spent a lot of my life and career trying to do that. And so when I moved into this role, I was like, oh right, okay, I'm actually now the leader of this thing. The pacifier people pleaser, that really is around not displeasing. And I was never that, really. I don't want people to be unhappy with me, but it was more for me that I wanted to go above and beyond and show how committed I was and how hardworking I was and how thoughtful I was. And then that last one that you mentioned, the resistor, are people who look like they don't care. But it's because they've checked out, because if they show they care, then there's more to lose. And I think you often find that in teenagers. I think it can happen with boys and girls. But I think that whole, I don't care, I'm not even going to sit my mock paper, I'm going to put my head on my desk because I'd rather look like I'm doing nothing than fear your judgment if I do badly. And so I think people pleasing starts very early in our lives. And I think if not dealt with, can cause quite severe consequences, to the point where I'm now having conversations with people who've been in headship 25 years and are saying, I'd have done things differently if I'd known this earlier. I wouldn't have lived my life this way, which is a big thing to say, isn't it, really?
It's massive. And I mean, just to talk about the sort of the setup of the book. So obviously it's incredibly well researched, as you would expect, and it brings in all of your experiences as well over that time. But you've also got the headspace, as you would expect with a book that's called Time to Think. We've got the headspace at the end, but the really thought provoking questions. I mean, I'm just looking at those before we started earlier on and just thinking, you know, what brings me joy and energizes me and pleases me in my job? I'm thinking now, obviously, in an incredibly challenging circumstance that we're in at the moment, there are things that do that. You know, we still get up every morning and we still want to go in. So it's nice to try and have some time to actually think about that and how that plays into, you know, what kind of things will make you happy at work, which is the end of the chapter.
It's really important because joy cannot be underestimated. You know, if we go to work, any workplace, and we're miserable, we won't want to go there for much longer. And I think one of the things that is a real challenge in schools is we don't ask people the question. And then we don't always listen to the answer. And certainly Marcus Buckingham, who talks about red threads, advocates, and I mentioned in the book, he advocates that 20% of every day is full of red threads, things that make you come alive. Now, that's different things for different people. For some, it's running the choir at lunchtime. For others, it's being on duty and having banter with young people. For others, it's teaching and learning, or it's behaviour, or it's policies, or it's writing the CEF. It doesn't matter what it is. The key thing is finding out what it is and then making sure you're spending at least 20% of every day doing that thing. You'd hope people would say teaching is the thing that brings them joy. I know that is not always the case, but even if it's certain classes that you just love teaching, that would be a red thread. And I think it's important. Life is too short not to find joy in what we're doing, including our work, I would say.
Yep, and I think, and just speaking personally, I think that the teaching bit is the bit that absolutely brings the joy. And that's the conversations that I've had with a lot of people recently. I think that's the part that people still, you know, really do enjoy and really get out of bed in the morning to try and do. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of discourse around the difficulties with teaching at the moment, but I feel personally that the young people currently enjoy some decent high quality teaching, perhaps more than they ever have, because they appreciate, you know, how difficult it is to get high quality teachers in front of them currently in the circumstances that we're in. But that's a whole different podcast, Rachel, isn't it? Perhaps better not get into. Now, again, these chapters just get better and better, listeners, because Rachel's, you know, I've done a lot of podcasts and a lot of books. This is very different in a very good way, which I like. This is really getting to the crux of what kind of things we're talking about current education. Now, I had a discussion last week with somebody, which I probably shouldn't discuss and I probably won't. And it's not necessarily in a work context, but it was talking about, you know, this kind of perception and the power of perception. So obviously our national discourse has been recently around sort of denial of, you know, facts and alternative facts and things like that. And I was discussing with somebody who works in industry, actually, not in education, but it was like, if you present the case that everything is all right, regardless of the myriad of problems that there are, and just say, no, everything's great, everything's fine, it's never been better, will people actually believe that everything is okay? And will that positive, albeit, you know, completely misguided positivity, will that have an influence? But in chapter three, you're advocating more what I think a lot of listeners would do is, you know, face those brutal facts head on, tackle them, and then still have, and this is the key bit, still have unwavering hope at the end. So why does that matter, facing the brutal facts and still having unwavering hope?
And it really matters. And it's one of the most difficult things in leadership to master, I would say, because you're on a tightrope there. It looks like you're not doing anything apart from you're using everything in your body to try and get the right balance. So the reason it's important is because if you only say that everything's wonderful and everybody knows it's not, you will look deluded. And leaders who look deluded lose followers pretty quickly, rightly so, because nobody wants to follow somebody who has no idea about reality. And so that is why it's important, because otherwise we look naive and stupid and nobody wants to look those things, I would hope. But if you only face the brutal facts and don't give people the hope and a plan to get to that hope, then people become disillusioned and don't want to listen to you anymore. And so that paradox of wanting to be very hopeful, but very realistic, and the way that you present that is really, really important. And when people go into leadership, no one ever tells you this. Like, literally nobody goes, listen, here's a top tip. Don't try and be over positive. Don't try and be over negative. Get the sweet spot between the two. And it's really hard. But, you know, I'll give you an example with Ofsted, because that's often what comes up. You know, it is a brutal fact to say that Ofsted judgment was not what we wanted. They've picked up areas that we're not happy about, or that we don't agree with, or that we do agree with, but are weaknesses. But we believe we are going to get to a different place. Let me paint you a picture of what we're going to do to this school to address these things. Here are the plans. Here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to bring people with us. Here's where I've made mistakes. Here's where we've made mistakes. And here's how we want to make it better and make it right for the sake of our young people and for the staff. And I think most people respect that kind of level of honesty. The problem with that is that people feel too vulnerable to do that. And so they whitewash things with pretense. And you see it in politics all the time, don't you? People going, no, nope, nothing to see here. Everything's fine. And we're all like, eh, are you not looking at the same thing we're looking at? It doesn't engender hope or belief or faith. And these things are important in leadership. They are so opposite fluffiness. And often people call them fluffy, and they're really not. If you don't have hope and you don't have the right balance, people won't want to work for you. Simple as that.
Do you know what, Rach? I wish somebody had told me this. If there's, I mean, not that listeners are going to need a particular reason to go out and buy the book, because we've already had 20 minutes of gold as to why they would go and buy. But this is the one, because I'm just thinking about people that I've worked with previously. And, you know, I'm not describing anyone that I've worked with previously as delusional, but I've certainly seen a denial and a refusal to face facts, square in the face, and acknowledge there's a problem here, which, like you said, you know, quite quickly can unravel. But equally, and again, I've been guilty of this, as I've alluded to previously, I've seen people who brutally acknowledge the facts, but just are very, very grumpy about them and constantly saying, well, this is awful, that's awful. And that doesn't bring people with you either.
Oh, it really doesn't. People going, well, there's nothing we can do. It's just what happens in communities like this, with kids like that, with parents like that. It's so depressing. And most people want to have an acknowledgement that this is really hard right now. This is not ideal. We're short-staffed. We've got loads of people off with various illness. Year 11 are not behaving themselves. We've got these 10 kids who are running around the school, vaping in toilets, and we can't catch them. It is not good. And we're all feeling stressed and overwhelmed. But let's imagine what it will look like when we get this under control, when we've got people settled in lessons, when parents are saying what a difference there's been, where people are wanting to come to our school, when our role improves, when these young people are 20 and they write to us and say, what I was taught in your school changed my life. I didn't realise it then, but I realise it now. And then you say to people, right, so if that's where we're going and we all agree that's where we want to be, how are we going to get there? And it's the first step. People forget the first step. They make these grand plans and then say, right, off we go then. And the staff are sitting there going, well, what do I do about tomorrow, period one, when it's still going to be the same problem? It's all just rhetoric. What are we actually going to do? And then you have to do it. You can't just talk about it. You actually have to do it. And that's where vulnerability and leadership is really important, to say, we've got this wrong. We've made a mistake. We introduced one change too many. We've hacked people off. Making you pay for your milk instead of just giving it for free, in hindsight, was a mistake because it made you feel undervalued. We're sorry. We're going to put it right. And apologies in leadership are not popular. You don't see it on the national stage. You don't see it in politics. You don't see people being willing to apologize because then they think they'll lose their job. And that isn't always the case.
Such good points. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you. Okay, so the next step, and it kind of links in, and obviously these chapters are kind of designed to do that, I'm sure. But because of all the problems, and by the way, you articulated every single problem in every single school up and down the country. You just did that effortlessly. Every problem that everybody's sitting there going, yes, they're all my problems as well. That was perfectly done. So, and all of those problems do exacerbate a busy, hectic, frantic culture in school, where any opportunity, whether it's a timetabled opportunity or whether it's just an informal opportunity to actually have a discussion with anybody that you're line managing or anybody that you're working with, and those conversations become corridor conversations, stolen couple of minutes, and that in itself feeds, you know, miscommunication and mixed messages. So the next chapter is how to listen to understand. Tell us a little bit about why that matters and how you see that currently unraveling in schools.
Well, people just don't, I think, is how I'm seeing it unraveling. People just don't. So when I asked a room full of 800 school leaders, these are head teachers or deputy heads, I said, can you put your hand up if you feel that you've been listened to for more than half an hour with unadulterated attention in the last month? And four people put their hands up. Four. And they all had coaches. So what we're saying is that in that level of leadership, in one of the most difficult roles, when you feel quite on your own at times, nobody is listening. And this, I think, is a real problem because we're busy, because we work, actually, people work in classrooms or in offices, and they're not necessarily in groups, and staff rooms have disappeared, haven't they? Because it's now an intervention room or some other such thing. So there's not much chance to get people together. And so people aren't listened to. And I just think we're just missing a massive trick here, because people have got really good ideas. I would absolutely back any human being to come up with something decent if they were just given 35, 40 minutes of just thinking and talking and being listened to and being asked really great questions. But we ask stupid questions, ones that we know the answer to in the first place, and it's guess what's in my head. We tell kids not to do that, tell teachers not to do that. You know, it's not guess what's in the teacher's head. And then we play the same game. So I think the rules of listening are really, really basic, but just because it's common sense doesn't mean it's common practice. So, you know, things like when you're in a meeting and you are talking to somebody, you know, how much are they interrupting you? They shouldn't. They shouldn't interrupt. It's the promise that changes everything, is what Nancy Klein says. I won't interrupt you. Asking good questions, saying things like, tell me more, or go on, or is there anything else? Instead of jumping in with our better thought that we'd like to interrupt because we've had a superior thought which you might benefit from, it's actually really insulting. And so I do think we need to give people time to express themselves, to be heard, to really think their own thoughts, because we all know deep down what it is we want to do or think if we're given the chance to express it. The problem is we're not. And I would say in school leadership particularly, that is a real challenge.
No, it absolutely is. And you also feel guilty, particularly in these high challenge situations that we're currently in, with staffing, absence, etc., that if you are spending some time having a conversation as a school leader with a colleague, you feel as if perhaps that's something that you should do after school or before school. And while you're in school and there are children present, you should be running around, you know, manically trying to make sure that children in class, lessons are going on and all those kind of things. And that's always going to be part of your role. But actually that conversation that you have for half an hour with a maths teacher on a Thursday afternoon might be the difference between you being fully staffed for the next term and, you know, having a completely decimated department. So it's really, really important.
And if you're curious enough and you are really open, and again, it comes back to what you stand for. If you really say you stand for integrity and humility and kindness and the rest of it, pursuit of excellence, like I say I do, then I have to listen to people. And I have to be prepared for their answer. So, you know, going around to your teachers, head of maths, head of English, head of science, and saying, if my answer was an unqualified yes, what would you ask me for? And just listen to what they say. Because they'll tell you if they're asked, but they won't tell you if they're not, because it takes real guts to go up to the head teacher and say, just so you know, we are really underfunded and we want some of this or that or the other. Will you please release some money from the budget? They won't. So we need to ask. You know, if you were the head in this school, what would you do first? If you weren't scared of failure, head of maths, what would you do differently? See what they say. Listen to what they say. These people are good people who are committed to teaching young people and have untapped talent right there. Don't need promotional points for it. Just need to be heard.
No, absolutely brilliant. Great stuff. Right. And again, the goal, it just keeps coming. This is another, I feel like I've been listening to The Rest Is Politics far too much, because I make everything into a political thing. But this particular chapter five, you know, is there a more used political phrase than let me be clear? Just so I'm absolutely clear when they're about to tell you something that they're really not at all clear about.
Yes.
So, and also, I mean, I was talking to Richard Verry, who was my previous head teacher on a podcast a few months ago. And he said, you know, you can give a message 3, 4, 5, 6 times, think it's been delivered. And he gave a very simple one that, you know, make sure you stay off the grass outside of the chapel. And everybody's on the grass outside the chapel. And he thinks message delivered and message understood are two very different things. So I know it sounds obvious, but why is being clear important? And then more importantly, how do you know you've been clear?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I think there are different answers to that question. I think you know you've been clear if the person you're saying something to understands. I mean, that's the first thing. And I think, you know, when you hear politicians say, let me be clear, and then they think they're clear, it doesn't mean that we are clear. It means they think they've been clear. And that's a different thing. And so part of the judgment of this is in the person who is taking the instruction. And what I see lots happening in school, and I had this myself, I have to say, is somebody asks you to do something. Would you mind taking on these year 11s for this extra intervention session? And because you're a people pleaser and you have no boundaries and you're, you know, giving your life over to the career that you've chosen, you say yes without ever understanding what exactly it is that you've been actually asked to do. Is there money? When is this meant to happen? Am I being judged accountable for this? Is this promotional opportunity? Am I doing it on my own? Do I have to organise all of this? We're not clear. And many of us find it embarrassing to ask those questions because we think it makes us look stupid. So we just kind of muddle on as best we can. So I think if we're going to be clear with people, we need to say, you know, Donna, would you mind taking on that year 11 intervention class for 25 year 11s? This is what it will mean. And we have to do what Brené Brown calls painting done. What does done look like? So what I'm hoping from you, Donna, is that you're going to take these boys or girls or mixed group or whoever, you're going to have them for an hour every week. You're going to do something that they can't do, work on their gaps. And after a period of time, we're going to assess them to see if they've made progress. If they have, then this will happen and that will happen. You've got any questions about that? Is there anything that you are not clear about? Or where have I not been clear? Is a better question to ask. Assume you haven't been and give them a way in to say that they haven't a clue what you're talking about. What we often say is, right, well, I'm sure that's clear now, or I've made that clear, or if you're not clear, let me know, instead of saying, where have I not been clear? So being clear is being kind. Being unclear is very unkind, especially if you are the highest paid person in the organization and you're dumping something on somebody else who has no idea what they're actually being asked to do and don't speak out. That is a very stressful situation to be in, and we shouldn't have it.
Just for the listener's benefit there, I was almost applauding as Rachel was going through that, because I know that you're talking in sort of more general terms, but I'm just thinking of meetings and things that I've been involved with, you know, particularly leadership over the years. And there's nothing worse than a long meeting with zero actions and no clarity on exactly what you're supposed to do. And,
like,
and you sit there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you sit there. Discussion? Information?
Well, yeah, but then people seem to think that the longer it goes on, the better it is. And every decision is, well, there isn't a decision. Every decision is, oh, I'll come back to you, or I'll get back to anything. There's no clarity whatsoever. So a short, sharp meeting with clear minutes, clear actions, clear... It puts people at ease a lot better than a long meeting where you think, it's back to that people pleasing thing, you think that by doing a long meeting and listening to everybody and letting everybody hear everything that they want to say is an effective meeting. People might feel better in the short term, but in the long term, if you don't know what you're doing, it can be incredibly stressful, can't it?
Oh, it's really stressful. If you're in a senior leadership team meeting, for example, and you are not a deputy head or at the kind of top of the structural tree, and you're asked to go along to a meeting, you have no idea. Am I meant to challenge? Am I meant to agree? Am I meant to say anything? Am I meant to not say anything? What do I do with myself? And we never make that clear to people. We just say, come to this meeting, and then you kind of crack on, and people are left the entire time panicking about what on earth they're meant to do. And am I making a fool of myself? Should I be speaking? Am I speaking too much? And that is really anxiety inducing. And then to leave with no clear agreement on what has been agreed when you didn't know what the point of the meeting was in the first place. No wonder we're all a little bit hacked off. And this happens everywhere. It's not just in schools. It happens in businesses too. Just lack of clarity over what we're here for, how we're going to behave, what we're going to end with, and making sure everybody is clear before we start.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, again, so you've referenced the next chapter, one of my current heroes of recent years in terms of books. So you've referenced James Clear and Atomic Habits and talking about boundaries and things like this. So you're talking about healthy boundaries. Now, you know, tonight, I'm sure that there's many things that Rachel could be doing rather than speaking to me. But of all the guests, and I've had some quality guests over these, if the one person I knew would be absolutely on time and would turn up, I knew this would be the case. And I've been thinking today, it's been a difficult day. It's been a stressful day. It's been a busy day. And you get to that point, listener, where you get to sort of, I don't know, 3:30 in the afternoon. You've just done a meeting or whatever it is. And you think, I've got a podcast this evening. It's going to be, you know, and it's going to be great. And I know it's going to be great. It's going to feel energized. I'm going to feel better. But there's a point where you think, well, I could always just put that off until next time. And I think, no. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to answer those 67 emails asking me, you know, ridiculous questions like someone's left a jumper in reception. I really don't need to know that information, but I still get them. And they're kind of pinging as we go. I thought I'm going to dedicate a bit of time for me and for you, the listener, to speak to Rachel about these kind of things. So that's one of the boundaries for today. This was going to be my time to have a conversation about leadership and other things that we've already talked about. So in terms of a question for this, we all, you know, know the importance of healthy boundaries, you know, work-life balance, all of those sort of buzzwords, but we're not very good at doing them for reasons that you talked about before. And, you know, again, I spoke to somebody fairly recently who it took a health scare. You know, they were, I mean, I'm not trying to break any confidences, but, you know, they're walking around with a blood pressure monitor fitted by the doctor. And it took to that point to think, hang on a minute, I might need to be a little bit more careful about how much time I'm spending in work and spend a little bit more time doing some exercise, having some rest, doing some other things. So it shouldn't get to that point before you realize that actually healthy boundaries are a good idea. So I'll stop waffling, Rachel, and come to a question. How important are healthy boundaries? And, you know, how important is it to kind of stick to deadlines and things that you've set for yourself, like this podcast, for example, and not just kind of resist or make you resist that urge just to plow on with more and more and more work?
Well, really important, I think, because in not sticking to your own boundaries, ones that you've put in place, you end up neglecting yourself. And I think that is the challenge. So I think the first question here, and I don't think I've covered this in that much detail in the book, but is to ask yourself what kind of boundaries you find difficult to keep. So Gretchen Rubin does a lot of work on boundaries and different types of personalities. And so I would be, by her definition, a classic upholder. So an upholder is someone who has their own internal boundaries and keeps them, and then has external boundaries and keeps them. So if I'm given a deadline, I'll meet it. If I set myself a deadline, I'll meet it. I'm all about the boundaries. If I say I'm going to do it, I do it. And I'm absolutely persistent on that. But there are other people who have different approaches. There's no wrong or right. We all have just different combinations. But if you're a rebel, for example, she defines a rebel as somebody who doesn't stick to their own boundaries and certainly won't stick to anybody else's, because, like, it's your boundary. Why should I follow that? You have people called obligers. Obligers need boundaries set for them, because they only tend to stick to them if somebody else is going to be harmed. So, for example, you'll only go to the gym if you're meeting your friend, or you'll only stop with a blood pressure monitor if you find you've got a scare and you do it for your wife or your husband or your kids. So sometimes people need that external accountability, and that's okay. But I think we need to know what kind of person you are. And I think we need to be better at celebrating boundaries. So I mean, I do this all the time with the colleagues that I work with. And I will say, I am leaving work at 4:30 tonight to pick up my child earlier from school to go to Costa. And I'll tell them the next day that I've done it. And I think it's really important that I am modeling that. So I'm taking a day off. I'm going to leave early. I'm not going to work at the weekends. You can send me emails, but you won't get an answer because I'm not answering at the weekend. And those are the kind of boundaries that I think are really important. And I know there's a whole debate at the minute on Twitter, like with everything, about emails at weekends. But the bottom line is, it's my decision, isn't it, whether I look or not. It's my decision. And where I sometimes fall down is I say I'm not going to look at weekends, and then I keep having a little peek to see how many I've got. And then I watch them rise. It doesn't happen anymore, I have to say. But I used to watch them rise and think, oh, I feel a bit panicky now. Oh, I feel a bit panicky now. All weekend. Didn't answer a single email. So I kept my boundary, but just felt anxious for the entire time. So some boundaries are really good for us. Going to bed early, even if you have too much work to do and need to be up till 1, still going to bed at 9:30 because you matter. Getting up in the morning, even though you're tired and don't want to get up at 5:30, if that's a good time for you to get your work done and you feel energized, that's how I work it. I get up early and I love that time in the morning. No one around, kids aren't pestering me, no emails, no phone calls. Great. But I think we need to work out what the boundary is doing and how it's damaging. And I think one of the things, again, it's all linked to people pleasing again, I think, is if you're a head of department who is modeling no boundaries, just ask yourself, is this attractive, what I'm modeling? Is my department going, oh, I wish I was like her. I wish I was like him. He's really got a good life, work-life balance here. Or are they thinking, if this is what it means for me, I'm not interested, I'll leave and I'll go and do something different. And I think we owe it to ourselves, we owe it to our families, we owe it to our colleagues to model good boundaries and stick to them, because we matter. We matter. If we are past ourselves, no one gets a good deal.
Such good points, Rachel. Thank you so much. And, you know, I mean, I agree with you about this, certainly about the childcare side of things and, you know, that going up and picking up for a coffee, that sort of thing. And I've been very lucky. I mean, I can say nice things about people that I work with, can't I? That's allowed. So, you know, my head teacher, she's very, very supportive of that sort of thing. So if you want to leave or you need to leave at a certain time, absolutely no problem. And I've never once, I mean, this obviously shows her integrity, never once been questioned for times when I've needed to leave at that time. Never once made anything about that. And then you do feel as if, well, that's really important to me that I get that done. And I come back fresher, happier,
exactly,
more ready to learn and ready to work the next day. So those things are really important. But also, it does a lot for your mental health and well-being as well. If you're fulfilling promises and obligations to yourself, doesn't it? I mean, that's the core of Atomic Habits. So, you know, I'm not trying to say I'm, you know, a triathlete or anything like that. But, you know, I have been on a run every day pretty much since April. And then I started thinking, well, I might have to go to the gym as well just to mix it up a little bit. So I've done that. And I met a friend there last week. I don't know why I'm telling you this, Rachel, but we're just having a nice conversation.
Yeah, I'm having a natter.
And she was in, exactly. She was in the cafe and I went in, I had a quick chat with her, how's work, et cetera. Went in. And then about 30 minutes later, I came out and she went, is that it? And I said, yeah, I've got 7 exercises that I need to do so many reps of, and I've done the cardio this morning. And she looked at me and thought, oh, right, okay. But I was fulfilling a promise to myself to do that.
Yeah.
And half an hour is more than sufficient for what I need to do. And if I do that consistently, I tick that off, I become, as James Clear would say, I become the kind of person that goes to the gym.
Yes, and that should be rewarded and celebrated, not hidden away, you know, going to bed early and reading a book or having a bath. Or they're my three. I call them the 3 B's, book, bed, bath. They're the 3 things that I love more than anything. I can have the worst day and I do 1 or 2 of those 3 things and I'm sorted for the next day. It's fine. It's like cleansing. But we should talk about that, shouldn't we? We should say, I didn't stay up late and mark my books last night. I went to the gym, I had a coffee. I went to the cinema on an actual school night. I mean, that's a whole revelation. Going out on a school night and seeing other actual adults out having meals and doing fun things. Like, what is this new world? So we should be able to say, I didn't work last night. And people should go, well done. That's amazing.
Absolutely. And with the emails, I mean, I've been at the forefront of this debate, as you know, but I'm coming round. I think you're convincing me. I'm coming round a little bit because actually I've lost the battle on the email protocol. I've got to be honest. We set up an email protocol 3-4 years ago, and I've lost the battle because, like anything else, if you don't stick to it, people don't do it naturally. So the emails have crept in after 7 o'clock. Well, I mean, tonight goes deluged in after 7 o'clock, and then the same at the weekends. But you're right, and my boundary is I'm not going to read those.
And you will not get a response from me, and people will stop sending them to get one because they won't.
Exactly, and that's the point. And that's the point. And everyone says, "Well, you don't respond to your emails." And I say, "Well, I will have read them if they're any of any use, and I'll be across the detail of knowing what I need to know. But I'm not going to be sending one back to you at 7:45 in the evening or at weekends. I will do some work on Sunday nights, and I'll do some work during the day. And tonight I will do some work because I want to. I'll plan a lesson because I like that." You know, I've got my fancy coloured pens here. I'm ready to go.
Well, that's why if you had good coloured pens, it's the answer to most things in life. I didn't put a chapter in the book about that, but the next one I will.
I think you should.
The importance of a decent coloured pen.
Well, indeed. And I've got lots of them.
Me too.
If the students don't steal them. Right. And then, now we always have a thing about leaving a listener wanting more, because I could talk to you all night and we could go through every chapter and then people go, well, I've done that now. I don't need to go and get the book because that's sorted. So it's nice that the last one I'm going to talk about is, and this is something that, you know, I do the first part of, but not very well the second part of. So how to say no, I'm good at that, without causing offence, not so much. So why is it important to be able to say no? And how do you do it without causing offence? And how do you do it without, you know, upsetting people as well, or creating a culture where we can kind of say no to everything, and then that, you know, we don't have that sort of, you know, whole school approach and that positivity and that all in the same boat or whatever, you know, description you want to use for that, you know, boats in the same direction, all on the same bus, whatever it is. So how do you say no without causing offence?
So this chapter in the book is where it is because it kind of needs all the other bits in place to be strong enough to do this. You need to know you're not a people pleaser, have boundaries. You need to know what you stand for and what you stand against. You need to be able to have difficult conversations and be clear and be kind. If you can nail those things, then saying no becomes an entirely different beast. So saying no is difficult, because we're worried what people will think of us. Will they think I'm a shirker? Will they think that I'm not as good as so-and-so next door? Will they talk about me? That's people-pleasing, because we're trying to say yes to get their reaction to be better. Are we wanting to say no, but we don't know how to say no? We can't have the challenging conversation. We don't know how to do it without being rude. or we just don't like the discomfort of not pleasing people. So what I've done here is I think there's about 10 different ways of saying no without causing offence, and I use all of them regularly, and I encourage anyone who works with me to use them back, and they do. And it's never offensive. If you say you stand for valuing people and listening to people, then this shouldn't be difficult. So the no is, there's lots of reasons for saying no, but essentially here what I've outlined is how you can say, no, I don't want to do it, but then offer a different way. So it might be, no, I can't do that intervention class on that Monday, but I could do it on Wednesdays. Or you might say, no, I'm afraid I can't do that because I haven't got time in my diary, but I am willing to renegotiate things if this is a priority. Or yes, I will do that, but there isn't time in my existing schedule to do that. So what would you like me to prioritise? Or yes, I think I might be interested in that, but could you just tell me a little bit more about what it would involve, please? So you stall the no or the yes, because the person who's asking you, if they're not clear what they're asking you, you shouldn't be saying yes to anything. So ask people to be clear. But that key one around, yes, I would like to lead on raising achievement across the school, but I've got another job to do as well. So which parts of my current job should I not do in order to focus on this? And see where that gets you. But I promise you it gets you in a better place than just saying yes blindly or saying no and being looking obnoxious. It's genuinely saying I'm willing to explore it, but I might not be able to do this. Or no, I don't want to do this, but I heard that Andy was really quite keen. You might want to ask him. Just make sure Andy is before you throw him under the bus.
Yeah, in my experience of working very close with an Andy, he's always very keen to do everything. And he'll probably be listening, so there you go.
That Andy can do it is a good way of saying no, but Andy will.
And he absolutely will. He absolutely will. Right, Rachel, thank you so much for your time tonight. And it's certainly given me, and I know I'm being corny now, time to think. It really has. And I'm so glad that we did it. I always am glad that I've done a podcast, but particularly this one, because I think this resonates really well with where we are as a profession and, you know, the time of year and everything else. So this is a really timely book. So to remember for listeners, so it's Time to Think, The Things That Stop Us and How to Deal with Them. And it's a John Catt book. So Rachel, just tell us a little bit about, because obviously we're now in October half term. So tell us when the book is available or if the book is available already and what kind of things you'll be doing to maybe promote the book, and tell listeners a bit more about where they can find you, social media, Pixel, etc.
Okay, so the book is out on the 13th of October, so it'll have been out a little while for half term, and you can buy that through Amazon or through John Catt's website. There is a second one coming at some point next year, which looks at what stops us as teams. This one is really about individuals. So that's the second one that's coming. If you like what you're reading and you want to hear more, then I've got two podcasts that I do. One is called Pixel Pearls, which is just 10 minutes of leadership reflection. Always start with a story. They're great for assemblies. A little bit of reflection on that story in three questions to ask ourselves. So great for Time to Think. And the other podcast that I do is called the Pixel Leadership Book Club podcast, where I interview two school leaders about a non-educational book and the lessons they've learned from it and implemented in school. So that's kind of the stuff that's all available out of there. And then also in my usual day job, I lead Pixel and we have conferences regularly. So if anybody wants to come as a guest, they'd be ever so welcome. You can go through the official channels of, I think it's admin at pixel.org.uk or membership at pixel.org.uk, or you can just email actual me at rjohnson@pixel.org.uk, and I would love to hear from people and I will personally respond.
Great stuff. Right, thank you so much for your time, Rachel. Really, really appreciate it, and I look forward to getting into the book in more detail, particularly during half term this week. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you so much.
Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Naylor's Natter the Book, ideas and advice from the collective wisdom of teachers. Naylor's Natter brings together a wealth of advice from the most influential voices in education today. In this exciting, one-of-a-kind book, Phil Naylor revisits the very best interviews from 3 years of education podcasting, drawing on the advice and opinions from some of the world's most innovative educators. Available now for pre-order from Amazon and out on July 7th, 2022.